This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, and stay tuned. We'll be right back after our little theme here and some interesting things to talk about here today. Yes, and this is, again, Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. One bit of business to point out before we get to today's show is that my computer is down. It's in the intensive care unit of the computer hospital. I have no idea what's wrong with it. So I haven't been posting as many regular little essays or articles as usual on the Occupied Territory Facebook page. So if it seems kind of blank or inactive for the last couple of days, that's the reason. Could be another week or so before I do have access to it. So what will be on there is the podcast for today's show, which will get posted later today, probably sometime. But you'll feel free to go on there and post anything you want yourself. It's just that I haven't been able to put anything on there and won't for a little bit of time. All right. Now, I think was it last week or was the week before that I mentioned something about my approach to this show and to politics in general? And this is, after all, about the Occupy movement and essentially about income inequality and its effects on everything. And it's been expanded to include all sorts of politics and cultural economic activity in the country. But something I was mentioning a couple of weeks ago is that somebody my age, I grew up in the 60s, well, I was in my 20s in the 60s, so I grew up in the 50s actually. So I'm an old dude, right? So people like me lived in a time when political action could really result in something. In other words, if you went out on the street and you protested, and given there were a lot more people involved, we're talking about tens, hundreds of thousands of people, every month or two, someplace or other, coordinated all the way across the country, ultimately millions of people a year protesting about civil rights and basically against the war in Vietnam. But we took it for granted when we grew up, and it seemed to be the case that if we got loud enough and there were enough of us, and ultimately there were riots too, not any that I was involved in, but there were riots. Cities burned. Police and firemen were shot at. The government got scared. The government doesn't, when I say the government, doesn't matter anymore. Republicans, Democrats, all the same. They got scared that they were losing control over the entire populace. And of course, whoever was in office or whoever was running at the time always got worried that, and in this case, it was Democrats who were in charge. It was Johnson, you know, at first Kennedy and then Johnson, they got worried they wouldn't be reelected because still it comes down to the vote. Now, the vote obviously has become almost meaningless because it's bought and sold. It's commodified like everything else because of the Supreme Court and because of the increasing prostitution of people in Congress and the president. However, at that time, despite the fact that there was always dirty politics, I mean, actually, is there another kind? But and the internal wheeling and dealing and the bribery and the corruption and the money involved. But it was nothing like it is now. It was bad, always bad, but nothing like it is now. But still, here's the point. We were able to get out on the street and actually, and even sometimes in a sort of a left-wing way, pull the Democratic Party closer to left-wing or radical or people's politics or people's issues than they might want to do, since they were in the Washington bubble and they were part of the problem and not the solution. It could be demanded at a local level, even at a national level, that they would be somewhat responsive. And ultimately, they were. I think the main point was that we could affect politics. The bottom line in those days was that by getting angry and getting out there and doing it over and over again and being very aggressive and breaking a lot of laws, not that anybody generally got hurt, but there was a lot of trouble, right? And by doing that in a massive, united way, and even it wasn't always united, it just seemed to be that way, but people did it independently. There was chaos, there was anarchy, but it all seemed to add up to the same thing. And in civil rights movement, it was far more directed, and it was, except when the riots broke out. Point being, we are able to change things. So we assumed, and we grew up during a time after the New Deal was still a big thing, right? The New Deal legislation, Social Security, the fact that the government would stimulate the economy, that they had they created safety nets for people, for the elderly, for the sick, that that there was a sense of responsibility, that they got involved in the economy, they got involved in people's lives and tried to make them better, to establish some sort of equality. There, for instance, there were price controls during the Depression and especially during World War II, price controls over everything. There were caps on rent. There was caps on fuel costs. There were even laws which were you know, aggressively pursued, prosecuted against against excess profits by business. There was, you know, people tried, you know, of course, there were war profiteers. People tried to profit off other people's death and misery and suffering and hard times. And the government came after them. Not like now, when the government not only doesn't come after the people who have destroyed our economy and profit over all, you know, off all our misery, medical, physical, you know, everything you can think of, you know, utilities, power. They don't bother them at all. In fact, these guys get to be Secretary of the Treasury or advisors to the president, or they play golf with the president or whatever. Not in those days. So things were actually different. They weren't. They didn't just appear to be different. That's always part of it. But they were actually quantitatively different. And people felt, especially in the 30s, when the Democratic Party was pulled way over to the left. When I say the left, I mean, what do I mean by that? I mean over to the cause of actual regular human beings and American citizens. That's what's called the left. So that's what I mean. So it was pulled over to the space where people were decent and tried to be equal and treat other people with respect and dignity, and to not hoard everything and treat other people like dirt. You know, the Ayn Rand philosophy, the Republican Party, if you will. So there was a big difference between the parties, and political power was changed by changing the Democratic Party. So the system seemed to work. And then in the 60s, although the Democratic Party was more and more, you know, corporatized and less responsive, still it was there was a lot of leftover New Deal stuff. I mean, Johnson was, after all, a New Deal Democratic congressman from Texas originally. You know, up during the New Deal. I mean, rural electrification was a big thing in Texas and other places like that. People didn't have electric lines out to their houses. And Johnson was very big for that. He brought actual, the ability to have phones, to have, to have electric refrigerators, all that kind of stuff to people who never had this stuff before, and everything else that the blessings of electricity, which are mixed just like the blessings of modern technology. But he brought that to people. These people had it in them to actually respond to what citizens wanted. And so the party was worthwhile supporting and voting for. Also, in the 60s, so 60s, you still had these leftover guys. The guys who were running the Democratic Party were still people who actually grew up and came of age and served under Roosevelt and were in that Congress and were in World War II. They had a sense of what it meant to die for your country, for in a war that actually meant something, and they were responsive to people. So in the 60s, we, that is to say my generation, we were the children of these people that I'm talking about. And we were taught that if we really tried, we could make a difference in the way the government functioned and how they treated other people, and they would take their job responsibilities seriously, that they would pass laws that had to do with equality, and that they would not steal money from all of us. They would not empower bankers. The laws restricting excess profits and what banks could do, and the hedge funds and everything like that. All of these laws were severe, and there were severe penalties for them, and people didn't break them. And the Justice Department did go after people then. And there was the Glass-Steagall Act, which prevented investment banks and regular commercial banks from merging with each other and gambling with regular people's depositors' money. No more, of course. So all of that. Then comes the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and now. What we have is two parties who are basically the same. And when now, after the 90s, or certainly in the year 2000 and beyond, when, you know, we've had two giant wars and we're still involved in one of them, And there's another gigantic war on terror, which we don't even understand because they don't let us know. That's none of our business. We're only the ones who pay for it and die in it. But it's not our business to get concerned. But once it was. So I'm from the generation that was brought up by people who really were able to change government's policies towards its citizens. And we expected that to be something that was true. And in fact, we got out on the street in the 60s, made a lot of noise, knocked a lot of things down, broke a lot of laws. You know, a lot of people paid for it with their arrests, beatings. There were riots. You know, so the street was where it was at. The regular Democratic Party was fighting the war in Vietnam. They were perpetrating and they were pursuing the war in Vietnam. So they turned out to be useless as far as we were concerned in my generation for doing anything good for anybody. They were just murderers, and they were taking money that didn't, you know, we didn't have, and paying for this insane, immoral war. We felt that we could stop it by getting out on the streets and exercising our rights to freedom of assembly and to free speech as guaranteed in the Constitution. And, of course, we were investigated by the FBI. There was something called COINTELPRO. There were provocateurs that the government, you know, and the government didn't have so many advanced weapons, but they spied on people. They tapped phones. They sent bad people into crowds to, you know, maybe take a shot at the cops or to maybe knock down a police horse. And so then the cops would lose control and beat everybody. And this is what happened. So you had to pay for this kind of thing, right? Power concedes nothing without a demand, a la Frederick Douglass. But what did we learn from that? We learned that if we could do this, we could change it. Sure enough, the war stopped eventually. And one of the reasons that the war stopped, in fact, the main reason the war stopped, because between the generals and all the Harvard experts that Kennedy and then Johnson used in his administration, like McNamara and all those people, they saw no reason to stop this war. Of course, no general is ever going to stop a war. It's the only way to get ahead, get lots of medals and lots of stars, and become famous. So we stopped the war. That is to say, my generation, who could see what was going on and who knew better, not people like Mitt Romney, who was my age, but was supporting the war from a safe distance in California, Stanford, or wherever he went. But so we stopped the war. And my generation browbeat and scared a government which wasn't really interested in doing this. After all, Johnson from Texas, who could never say Negro. Johnson, the best he could do was Negroes. It's from deep from the South, right? So this guy is in 1965, President Johnson is making a speech about certainly are Negro citizens. As close as you can get to saying nigger, right? You should pardon the word. And that was Johnson. Nevertheless, he grew up. He came up in that Democratic Party, which had a sense of morality and responsiveness to people. And all the riots and all the threats and all the marches and the protests, you know, Martin Luther King and then even Malcolm X, they changed their ways and civil rights laws were passed. So that was my experience. So that's why all of this is to explain. That's why I still come on here and sometimes get angry at what the president does. And, of course, we should be angry that the president is usurping his powers to become a dictator and basically squashing democracy in the mud. Yeah, we should get angry about that. But the idea that you could vote, I guess I'm talking systemically here, the idea that anymore that you could vote for a congressman or a congressperson or a senator or a governor, perhaps even, but especially on a national level, that you could vote for a congressperson or a senator or the president, and it would make any difference, really. Yes, again, to qualify, there is a slight difference between the Democrats and Republicans. When it comes to basic things like our Constitution, our economic equality, there is no difference. No difference. Yes, when it comes to rights, if you're gay, if you're a woman, when it comes to marriage rights, when it comes to voting rights, these are very important things. But when it comes to free speech, privacy, the Fourth Amendment, and the Fifth Amendment, when it comes to search and seizure, when it comes to the military taking over, you know, facets of law enforcement in the United States, when it comes to spying on its own citizens, when it comes to perpetrating and fighting incredibly costly and expensive, murderous, immoral wars, nothing is different between the Republicans and the Democrats. In fact, this guy, this Democratic administration and this Democratic Congress is as bad or worse than a lot of what Bush and Cheney did, if possible, but they are. So I still get angry about that, and I think we should all still get angry about that. But it's not going to be changed by working within the Democratic Party or voting. And the reason I mention all this is because it's hard for me to change. After all, my parents brought me up. They were, you know, good, solid, left-wing, Roosevelt, liberal Democrats, which counted for something, and it meant something once. And they brought me up this way. Then I go out in the streets, which they didn't like, because they were able to change things. But in fact, that's a little less knowledge of history than they should have had. Because in the 30s, there were gigantic, almost out of control protests and marches by the Communist Party and workers people were starving. And the cops tried to subdue these things. And sometimes they had to call the army in. This is what happened. But these people, you know, people get older, they get more conservative. So like my father, who was a real City College communist type in the 30s, you know, was out there striking and screaming about fascism in our own government, too, and whatever. He dealing with the cops himself. He forgot about that. He got older. He has a job as an executive at a chemical company. You know, he's an engineer. He has to pay for college educations for his kids. He has to, you know, pay for the mortgage on two houses eventually. You know, you just get older. You slow down. It's in the way of things that older people become more conservative. So I have to wean myself, and I mentioned this last week, I think. I have to wean myself off getting so outraged at the Democratic Party and at the president, at the executive, as if that rage would change anything. So I am finally learning what I'm sure entire generations under the age of 40 already know, that it doesn't make any difference if you get out on the street, if you write a letter to your congressman. I'm always amused by still the constant emails I get from places like Move On or People for the American Way, and there's 50 places with names like that, or other groups, even environmental groups. I get all these emails saying, make sure that you contact your congressperson and let them know you don't approve of this pipeline. You don't approve of drones. Really? Why waste your finger effort? Why give yourself even one little bit of carpal tunnel syndrome, you know, writing to a congressperson or to a senator or certainly to the president? I mean, who couldn't care less? So finally, I'm talking out loud here because I have to convince myself. This is a show that was dedicated, that was born with the Occupy movement, that is dedicated to the Occupy movement and its goals and everything else that affects, which is everything. Income inequality affects everything. But still, you will hear me, you know, talk about these things. So little by little, you have to have patience with me. I know there's whole generations that already know this and don't even bother to struggle with it. But they didn't grow up seeing that they could affect their government. Now, they grew up their whole lives knowing that nothing they did. You may have been, I don't know, some of you may have actually been part of demonstrations against invading Iraq, which were massive. There were millions of people that turned out in several different American cities. I know there was something like several hundred thousand on the streets of New York City. And a lot of these people were people from my generation who remembered that when they turned out, they were able to change the government's policies. This time around, they were penned in by the cops and by, you know, whatever, God knows, you know, orange netting and GPS satellite positioning and everything else. And not a damn thing happened. It couldn't matter. It didn't make any difference. And this is the same way all over the world, other countries that are democracies too. In England, several million people turned out. In this country, it would have been 20 or 30 million, you know, per population. And all over Europe, people turned out to condemn this war. Don't get involved in it. They didn't want Britain to get involved in it. Didn't make any difference. Doesn't make any difference. Your vote really doesn't make any difference. And why do I say that? Okay, so you went to the polls last November and you elected, let's say, a Democratic senator or a Democratic congressperson, or you elected the president. You voted for the president. Okay, and you feel really good. We didn't have Romney and those awful other people. But what we did was we still voted for somebody who is trashing the Constitution so fast that he can't even keep up with his own self. Somebody who is a corporate tool, son of a bitch, as bad as Romney could ever possibly be. Having said that, I submit Exhibit A to the jury. That is you. And so you have to have patience with me when I try to wean myself off this whole idea that it makes any difference. And I'll get to a little bit about how people feel about government and how we should view government later on and how a lot of people still do. This is from, I think, the Huffington Post. On the same weekend that 40,000 people gathered on the Mall in Washington, and that's a lot these days, and it's cold, right? 40,000 people gathered on the Mall in Washington to protest construction of the Keystone Pipeline, which would be a major, actually an unmatched ecological disaster for the United States. On the weekend that 40,000 people gathered on the Mall in Washington to protest the construction of the Keystone Pipeline, to its critics, a monument to carbon-based folly, which it is, President Obama was golfing in Florida with a pair of Texans who are key oil, gas, and pipeline players. Obama has not shied away from supporting domestic drilling, especially for relatively clean natural gas, which is bullshit. There is no such thing. But in his most recent State of the Union speech, he stressed the urgency of addressing climate change by weaning the country and the world from dependence on carbon-based fuels. You know, I don't know what he means when he talks. I don't even know if he knows. And then there's a quote from he said here, some Orwellian moment that he had, where he was going to please everybody. And but on his first Guy's Weekend away since he was reelected, Guy's Weekend, the president chose to spend his free time with Jim Crane and Milton Carroll, leading figures in the Texas oil and gas industry, along with other men who run companies that deal in the same kinds of carbon-based services that Keystone would enlarge. They hit the links at Floridian Yacht and Golf Club, which is owned by Crane and located on the Treasure Coast in Palm City, Florida. Now, I know I'm not a member of that club, but I suppose lots of you are, so I don't want to upset you. I don't know. You might want to reconsider your membership in the club. I know a lot of you are members of the Floridian Yacht Club. Mr. Carroll is the chairman of CenterPoint Energy, a public utility company based in Houston, Texas. He is not a major donor to political candidates, having given just $5,800 since 2007, including $2,300 donation to Obama's first presidential campaign. CenterPoint Energy benefited from the 2009 federal stimulus law signed by Obama through its receipt of $200 million in federal grant money to upgrade its system to a smart grid. You and I had to give our money to this man, Mr. Milton Carroll, to help $200 million to upgrade his system. Now, $200 million is probably the profit that this man made in 1 month, but we had to give him the money. He couldn't reach in his own pocket for it. CenterPoint is not Carroll's only connection to the energy industry. Both Carroll and Crane are directors at Western Gas Holdings, the managing partner of Western Gas Partners, a midstream energy provider created by Anadarko Petroleum, one of the largest publicly traded oil and gas companies. Western Gas Partners' main investment is in the booming field of natural gas exploration, transportation, and manufacture in Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, and Wyoming, where people are even now getting cancer, animals are dying, and the groundwater is being poisoned. I'm adding that. Unlike Carroll, Crane has been more active in campaigning and campaign fund circles. In 2012, he gave the maximum $5,000 to the Obama campaign and $30,800 to Democratic National Committee. In 2010, he gave big to Democratic Texas gubernatorial candidate Bill White with $125,000 in contributions. Crane's donations have exclusively flowed to Democrats since 2002. I guess that's why he gets to play golf with the president while you can sit in your apartment and freeze to death. Before that, he made a few contributions to Republicans, including blah, 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 blah. Let's see. The president's spokesperson, that is to say, whoever was wearing high heels and getting, lubed in the rear here by the president. The president could not have been clearer, he said, in both his second inaugural address as well as the State of the Union address, that continuing to confront climate change is a top priority. In fact, don't fall asleep on me now. In fact, the president has already taken historic action on this issue in the wake of congressional inaction during his first term. This included establishing standards that will blah, 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 blah. Okay, environmental groups have seen their policy priorities move up on the national agenda after Hurricane Sandy struck the East Coast, and many were excited by the president's pledge in his State of the Union address to take executive action if Congress fails to pass a climate bill. Were you excited by his pledge in the State of the Union address? Then you're like me. You need to wake up and grow up like I'm trying to do. But Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program, said the president's new rhetoric around climate change doesn't square with his choice of golf partners or what with what he called Obama's all of the above energy strategy. A golf outing does not make policy, but it's clear that folks in the oil industry have access to the president. Would people stop, please, using this word, folks? I hate this word. The people, Milton Crane and this other guy in the oil and gas industry, these aren't folks. These are pigs, sharks, and sons of bitches. They are not just plain folks, and neither is Obama. This is such a nasty word, the way it's used. Volkswagen, a big company during the Nazis' reign. A golf outing does not make policy, but it's clear that folks in the oil industry have access to the president, Slocum said. The president has made his clear, very clear, his firm commitment to not just the oil and gas sector, but to expanding the oil and gas sector by increasing production, by, as he said, cutting red tape and expanding offshore drilling. Other environmentalists contacted by HuffPost agree. Obama's got a choice to make, said one. He can either side with big oil or he can join the more than 40,000 Americans who came to Washington last weekend, along with the millions more clean energy supporters across the country, and take us forward on climate change by saying no to Keystone XL. This is from Jamie Henn, a spokesman for 350.org, a climate advocacy group. Bill McKibben is in charge of that. You may know him. Young people may not be so good at golf, but we vote in record numbers, and we're overwhelmingly on the side of climate action. Michael Brune, executive director of the Sierra Club, found Obama's golf outing less unusual than he'd like. You can't throw a rock in Washington without hitting a deep-pocketed oil executive, which is why nearly 50,000 Americans had to come to the nation's capital to remind the president that the vast majority of Americans agree with his calls for climate action. There's an old adage that you're only as good as the company you keep, but we know President Obama can't prove anything, can't prove that saying wrong and do more, blah, blah, blah. In some ways, Henn noted, a coastal resort in Florida is a peculiar place to try to avoid talk of climate change. If the sea level rises, it will be among the first places to go. So here's the president. He makes this speech. Places like the New York Times, other people left over like me, maybe once upon a time, Democrats, liberals, because they don't want to get involved. I mean, life is hard enough because you don't want to like get out on the street, because you don't want to really, you know, look around for another candidate because, well, we've got the two candidates, because you don't want to do all this, because you're passive and almost to the point of paralysis, because you've seen in the last 10 years that nothing you do makes any difference to these corrupt bastards. The president gets up there and he says in ringing tones to a national audience, we must transfer to renewable energy. We have to get away from this carbon. Yeah, at the same moment, watch what he does, not what he says. This man will say anything. He is really kind of mentally ill, or he is just dishonest. He will say anything. Words don't mean anything to him. He will say whatever he has to say to get people to do whatever it is he wants. But he doesn't mean it. So the first chance he gets, first break he gets, after a couple of months worth of dealing with all these problems in Washington, and he goes off to relax. Who does he go off to relax with? The worst people in the world. People who are ready, willing, and able to destroy our environment. These are his friends. You are not his friend. You are not his friend. Here's another one, and I exhibit B here to the jury. Front page of the New York Times Wednesday. A digital shift on health data swells profits. Big companies cash in. After lobbying, a payoff for installers of new record systems. It was a tantalizing pitch. Some got a piece of a $19 billion government giveaway. The approach came in 2009 on a presentation to doctors by Allscripts Healthcare Solutions, I love these names, of Chicago, a well-connected player in the lucrative business of digital medical records. That February, after years of behind-the-scenes lobbying by Allscripts and others and other companies, legislation to promote the use of electronic records was signed into law as part of the President Obama's economic stimulus bill. The rewards, Allscripts suggested, were at hand. But today, as doctors and hospitals struggle to make new record systems work, they don't work very well, by the way, the clear winners are the big companies like Allscripts that lobbied for that legislation and pushed aside smaller competitors. While proponents say new record-keeping technologies will one day reduce costs and improve care, profits and sales are soaring now across the records industry. At Allscripts, annual sales have more than doubled from $548 million in 2009 to an estimated $1.44 billion last year. Guess who they gave a lot of money to for his reelection? Lobbying in Washington. Why should anybody make a profit of so much as one penny off something that has to do with our health? A healthcare company, a hospital, a doctor, nobody should get rich off the misery and suffering of other people. And yet they do every day because they bribe the people in power, including the president and the Democrats. There's a total commodification. There's a commodification of everything in this country. I mean, after all, this has been going on since the day the first European, the Dutchman or Englishman set foot on this continent. Everything has turned into business, profit, money, and ownership, private ownership. The latest thing is that a company in Florida, the University of Florida, or the University of Florida, Southern Florida, whatever it is, one of these universities down there, has allowed for something like a couple of $100,000, has allowed their stadium to be called, it's being renamed. This week, Florida Atlantic University announced plans to christen its football stadium in honor of GEO Group, a private prison corporation. Quote, "It's like calling something Blackwater Stadium," a critic told Greg Bishop of the Times. Meanwhile, the folks at University of Louisville are cheering for their basketball teams in the KFC Yum Center. Yum is the parent company of fast food chains like Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and KFC. Union-busting, environmental-destroying companies, if there ever were. It forked over, that is the Yum company, it forked over $13.5 million to imprint the stadium for the next decade. Sandra Kendall, the marketing manager for the center, said the exclamation point, Yum, by the way, has an exclamation point, the KFC Yum Center, said the exclamation point was part of the deal. The folks in Louisville, there it is again, the folks. You say folks, it means you're a regular person. You wouldn't harm a fly. The folks in Louisville, she said, do not find this disturbing. This is all from an article by Gail Collins today in the New York Times, mentioning that the Postal Service is looking to launch a clothing line. It's true. The Postal Service is going to launch a clothing line. The clothing line, Postal Service's new line of clothing, the agreement with some clothing company will put the Postal Service on the cutting edge of functional fashion. The Post Office is going into the fashion business. They're getting a license. They have a licensing deal where they're getting part of the profits, where they're going to put out clothes that look like postal delivery clothing, you know, like the shorts and the pith helmet and whatever else that they wear, right? There's going to be a whole line in like Macy's and in stores all over the country of official United States Post Office clothes, a whole kind of different fashion, which will probably catch on with about 500,000 brainless teenagers and some other people. They're going to wear this junk, right? And the Post Office will make money from it, which is all jive entirely because Congress set it up that the Post Office is going to get privatized. Just pay a little bit of attention to the fact, you know, the Post Office announced recently they're going to stop Saturday delivery, right? They can't afford it anymore. They're going broke. They lost $8 billion last year. They lost $7 billion the year before, et cetera. They can't afford to deliver the mail. The mail. They can't afford to deliver the mail on Saturday anymore. They're going to stop that in August. And basically, what's going to happen is within a couple of years, Congress will vote and the president will sign a bill into law to shut down the Post Office and give all the business to whoever, Federal Express, United Parcel, or somebody. All of this is a total setup that's been going on for many, many years now. A bill was gotten up, and this is partially because of lobbying from unknown sources and from Democrats and Republicans together. A bill was gotten up that, and I can't give you the details of it, but it provided for the fact that the Post Office had to have enough money saved up in its budget and couldn't spend money on other things like delivery or improvement in maintenance over its facilities or trucks or whatever. But it had to save a gigantic amount of money up out of what it made each year to guarantee pensions on a pretty high level for postal delivery people for the next 75 years. There is no such thing like this anywhere else. This is the kind of thing that very smart people in business set up to fail so that they can come in and pick up the pieces after it breaks. And then they could sell the pieces off or they could make something out of it themselves. It's a clear setup to take the post office private. So all of these football stadiums and basketball stadiums at universities, there's a few things left over. There's a Joe Louis Arena, you know, where they play hockey and they play basketball in Detroit. There's Yankee Stadium. But you know how everything is, everything is the... The Kentucky Fried Chicken Bowl. I mean, even the bowl games, right? These bowl games. Here from Gail Collins. Let's see. Whataburger. Oh, right. Auctioning off your motto is nothing. Let's see. When you're strapped for cash, dignity is the first thing to go. Just ask the members of the minor league baseball team in Corpus Christi, Texas, who play their games at Whataburger Field. Auctioning off your motto is nothing, really. We have lived with the sale of naming rights so long that generations of Americans have grown up taking it for granted that it is a fine thing to see your college team end the season by winning the Beef O'Brady's Bowl. Remember when Houston was stuck with Enron Field in 2001? Embarrassing for a second, but then the city resold the naming rights to Minute Maid for $170 million. Everything is being sold. There's some small city off in Arizona that sold off their town hall to a private company, to a real estate company. And now they're leasing it back. Presumably that's cheaper than having to maintain it themselves. Public land is being auctioned off. The rights to drill on public land is being auctioned off to mining companies, massive giant mining companies. They're going to drill for gold. They're going to drill for other minerals. They're going to sink wells for oil and gas exploration on public land, land that was set aside 100, 120 years ago during President Theodore Roosevelt's term to benefit, to keep it pristine and to benefit the people of the United States. They could just go there and get a break from their regular urban city lives. And they would see nature unspoiled. And he felt that it was a part of the government to preserve these places. Now the President of the United States routinely grants oil and gas leases to these companies and mineral exploration rights to these companies who will destroy the land. They will kill every animal on it. They will destroy the beauty of the land. They'll dig up the they'll cut into cliffs, into canyons. They'll dump junk into rivers. They will blow up forests. They will destroy everything in the environment to claw their way into this. And it will be impossible to put it back together again. And the government, because of some lobbying out there, you know, with senators and congresspeople and the president, because of massive lobbying for 150 years by these companies, they pay something like a 0.0111% license fee on whatever they get out of the ground. I mean, while we're prostituting ourselves and selling off public land, that is, the government is doing it, they should get 50% of whatever the sales is, right? Of whatever the huge profits they're going to get on this. No, because of some special loophole in the law, because of sheer bribery of senators and congressmen like Harry Reid, particularly, and other people, the government will get some ridiculously low percentage of the profits on these things. And, of course, these companies won't have to pay taxes either. And the government will give them yearly grants of hundreds of millions of dollars to help them in their exploration. All of this is corruption. It has nothing to do with you and me. A total commodification of everything. Is this new in America? Of course not. Everything has been commodified. The Dutch showed up here in the 1620s in Manhattan, and it took them about 10 or 15 years to murder every Indian in Manhattan, chase them off the island. First of all, they bought it for $26 worth of glass beads and knives or something. And the Indians didn't understand what they were doing. Then they had them sign a document turning over the property to the Dutch West India Company, whatever it was. What difference did it make to them? God, the Great Spirit, whoever, gave this land to everybody in common. No tribe owned it, really, although there's turfs and turf wars. No tribe really owned it. Nobody could own the land or the air or the water or a river or anything that grew in it or any animal in it. That was absurd. It was insane. It was so wrong that it was unthinkable. and they sign some document. They get, you know, beads and glass, and they thought, well, this is fun or interesting for the day. The Dutch take this document and use it as an excuse to murder everybody on the island, chase them all into New Jersey, and then ultimately, we see the history of this, destroy every vestige of Indian culture, life, land, everything. Just chase everybody onto reservations, murder tens of millions of people eventually, and drive them into misery and alcoholism and poverty. And now they've got the casinos, but that's a weird turn of events. And one of the most important things that the Dutch brought over here, and then the British, and this whole Calvinist attitude, and this whole kind of industrialized attitude, and well, although this is pre-industrial in the 1620s, 30s, and 40s, was this idea is if you have land, if there is land somewhere, and there was, of course, massive amounts of land, I mean, unbelievable amounts of land, forest and fields and just astounding amounts of land in the New World, new to them, not to the people that lived here. And they had a principle which they devised over there, which is pure land grabbing and pure corruption and immorality. If you've done this, and it grows out of Christian busybody improving what the Lord gives you, you know, the worst kind of fundamental crazy Puritan Christianity. If you have land, or if there is land and it's not being developed, in other words, if it's not being used for fields or to grow things or to cultivate, then that land can be seized by the government. That's what they called it. I forget there's some phrase for it. And it's in common law and in the law in England and the United States for hundreds of years. And it started in the 1600s. Any land that they saw, so the Indians live here for 1,000 years, 1,500 years, whoever, 2,000 years. They're living here, right? They understand because they have a sense of what's right and wrong, which the Dutch and the British, if they ever had it at all, left back home. They have a sense that the land can't belong to anyone. Nor can the air, or the water, or the animals, or anything that grows. It's impossible for it to belong to anybody. The Great Spirit created it, and it will go back into the earth, and it will become its, you know, et cetera, the whole cycle of life. And along come these people who say that they own that herd of buffalo. They own that piece of forest in Manhattan. They own that 100,000 acres of lakeland in upstate New York or something like that. And they said, what? And they continued to fish and hunt and to, you know, keep their camps there. And they were evicted, sometimes violently, often violently, and murdered and arrested and tortured and thrown out and driven away because of this commodification. It's as old as the beginning of European settlement of the United States. Everything has got a name. Everything has, everybody owns something. Everybody is owned. Everything is owned. Everything is owned. And corporations now own the government. And this is where we're at. This is where we're at. So, and it's so typical. There's a case in front of the Supreme Court right now. I don't know when I, Mr. Engineer, how much time do I have left? Okay, thank you. Thanks. There's a case in front of the Supreme Court right now. And I may have mentioned this last week. It's a man named, a farmer, whose name is Vernon U. Bowman, who's a farmer from Indiana. And this is a very, very important case in front of the Supreme Court. And there's a report here in the New York Times just yesterday by the Supreme Court reporter that it's very clear from the questioning of the lawyer for this farmer. He's a small farmer. He has 300 acres of soybeans out in Indiana somewhere. The questioning was so hostile and so overwhelming from all the justices on the bench towards this guy's lawyer that everybody is taking it for granted how they're going to decide, that there's no question that they will come down in favor of. And who is he suing, this lawyer? Monsanto. Maybe in the history of corporations, along with some German ones during World War II, and certainly with DuPont and other country companies in our country, maybe the most nasty, vicious, destructive corporation on the face of the earth in the history of corporations. Agent Orange, their Roundup, they have this weed killer, which is used all over the world, whether farmers like it or not sometimes, but it's effective and they use it. This weed killer, which selectively will kill weeds better than anything else, it's called Roundup. And it will not kill soybeans and corn or whatever else. In other words, they worked for a long time on that. They patented their discovery. Roundup, I can't even begin. I'd have to do 500 hours of radio programming here to begin to tell you the harm that Roundup does to the ground, to the environment, to the air, to water, to other crops, even to the crops it's supposed to not affect, and to certainly to people's genetic makeup. Roundup can cause cancer. Roundup does cause cancer. Roundup is one of the worst things that's ever been invented. It's very effective at killing weeds. And farmers have been using it for a long, long time. They've been using lots of things. DDT, until they found out that that was destroying babies and deforming babies. Now they use Roundup, which is one of the most extraordinarily awful things in the world. And it's used all over the world. So not only are they using Roundup everywhere, right? And farmers have to use this stuff. And it spreads to other fields. It migrates because what happens with the Roundup is that it, after they spray it on things, it dries. And then it migrates in the air as particles to other fields, right? So it's everywhere. It's in our food everywhere. You're eating this junk. You don't even want to know what's in it, right? So now what does Monsanto do? They find that they make seeds. They've come up with super seeds that they developed in their laboratories, let's say for soybeans. And soybeans is the most popular crop in the world. It's used for virtually almost anything. Flavoring, eating, you know, there's no end to what soybeans are used for. Filler, there's nothing. People, you know, and tofu and soy and everything. So they come up with a soybean seed that they invented in their laboratories, right? And this soybean seed is better. It grows, I don't know, it grows bigger soybeans. God knows what it does to your system. They'll find that out 5 years from now, and there'll be a class action suit, and Monsanto will settle for $1.50 and a trip to Disneyland with the government, right? But they came up with a seed that is resistant to the effects of their own poison, Roundup, because Roundup was causing some trouble for some soybean farmers, right? But they found that they create a soybean seed, invented in their labs, and patented, right, through altering the genetic makeup of a soybean seed. They patent this. And so what they do is they sell these seeds to farmers all over the country. Now, something like 80 or 90% of farmers have to use them because everybody's using this Roundup, this poison to kill weeds. They sell this seed because it's resistant to Roundup. Talk about cornering a market, right? It's too much, right? And here's the catch, though. If you're a farmer and you're just getting by, or if you're big or even a little farmer, especially if you're a little farmer, a mid-sized farmer, you have to buy new seeds every year. They will not allow you to take the seeds each year after the harvest, as farmers have been doing for tens of thousands of years all over the world in a natural way. They will not allow you, Monsanto, to use these seeds again. They have even sent Department of Agricultural enforcement agents and even occasionally local cops into places where farmers have been known to be keeping these seeds, as farmers have always done and should do from the plants that they grow. No, every year you have to buy new seeds. And of course, they raise the price. This is how it works. This is how it works. This is as bad as anything the mafia could ever do. Think about Goodfellas, the movie, where they buy a nightclub, where they sort of go in a nightclub, right? Because the nightclub guy is in debt. So they go in a nightclub and they take the guy's account. So they charge up fur coats. They charge up things that have nothing to do with the nightclub. They charge the guy to the point of bankruptcy where he's completely broke. And they're selling this stuff. They charge everything on there. They don't have to pay for anything because it's on the guy's account. They charge fur coats. They charge, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases of liquor he doesn't even need. They charge jewelry. They charge everything that has nothing to do with his business. He goes broke. When they can't make any money out of the place anymore, it's got to be closed down for debt, they burn it down and collect the insurance. That's what the mafia does. Monsanto makes the mafia look like a ladies' tea club. Get it? And this guy, this one guy, this farmer, is suing them because what did he do? He got in trouble because he went to a grain elevator, a grain storage, you know, place out in Indiana. And he bought some mixed seed, regular seed, and some of this special seed, patented seed, that Monsanto made. And he bought it mixed together and decided that he would use it on his crops, use it for planting. And Monsanto went after him, and he's lost in every court. Now he's in front of the Supreme Court, who clearly looks like they're going to come down on the side of this. And why? Because there's a precedent here. If he wins, then it could endanger all the patents on medicines, on DNA tests, on drugs, on vaccines, on everything that all these drug companies make so much money on, obscene amounts of money on, chemical and drug companies and medical supply companies and software and cell lines and everything. In other words, there are patents right now. Monsanto or some other company or some medical company, pharmaceutical company, came up with a patent on their research that they did. They have a patent on a test, a genetic test for DNA test for susceptibility to breast cancer. But you can't do anything with that. In other words, they're going to charge you $500 for this test, maybe once every 6 months or whatever that they can get away with, because there's no cap on these things, right? They charge you for this, and every time you have to pay for it all over again. And nobody can do any research because they own the patent on it. Nobody can do this, and it doesn't belong to anybody. It all belongs to them. In other words, a lot of drug companies and medical supply companies and places like that and chemical companies, they own parts of you. They have patented the genes. They have patents. They own the genetic makeup of people's bodies and various diseases that you get and what your brain is like. And you can't do anything about it except pay them a lot of money if you want to get yourself fixed or understand what's going on with you. They stop all kinds of other research by public interest groups dead in its tracks. And they cannot. There's no way that the Supreme Court, who are also subsidiaries of the corporate state, they can't let this farmer simply collect seeds at the end of the season and plant them again, because it'll put Monsanto out of business and all the other drug and pharmaceutical and software companies out of business that make so much money off all of us. And really, this is America. This is what America is today. There's a book that just came out recently, and I'm going to have the editor, one of the two editors of this book, on my show here on Occupied Territory in about 3 or 4 weeks. His name is David Bollier. This book is called The Wealth of the Commons, A World Beyond Market and State. The Wealth of the Commons, A World Beyond Market and State. This book is very, very academic. It seems like it's almost written for graduate students to begin to understand it, or for professors at universities. And in fact, partially it is. One of the reasons this guy pitched this, there are 72 articles in here by professors and researchers from all over the world on the idea of the commons. Once upon a time, and this is in England, there was common land that belonged to everybody. Although it titularly, you know, by title, it belonged to the landlord. Think of Downton Abbey, you know, Lord Bootley Snap or whatever his name is. You know, all of these lords in England, the landlords, owned everything, right? It was parceled out by the king, a monarchy. People had nothing to do with it, no democracy. And local farmers rented their farms from these lords. But there was always, between the farms or in between them, is centralized something called the commons, which was fields and grass and woods where they could hunt and raise extra crops so they could live and survive, because they had to pay all this money and part of their produce to the landlord, who never did a damn thing, of course, just like at Downton Abbey. And we're supposed to feel sorry for these assholes. It's very hard for me to watch that show, but my wife likes to watch it. I have to shut my mouth under penalty of death while I watch this show, but it's impossible. So there was commons. What happened is, in the 17th and 18th century, they decided, since these landlords didn't have enough money, you know, they couldn't afford the fifth castle or whatever it is, or needed more money to their ridiculous, absurd, obscene lifestyle, they shut down all the commons and sold it off, or used it for their own produce or their own hunting. And they arrested people and put people in jail for a long time for so much as even trying to get a rabbit out of there, as they had been for 50,000 years before that, or raise even a, or even pick a berry out of it. And they drove all these people, all these farmers, into cities because they no longer could survive. And these people served as fodder for the new industrialization in the cities. And this is where Dickens writes about all the poverty and the misery in England, in London, especially in the cities. And this is the way it works, right? There are things that we should all have in common. The land, the water, the air, vast stretches of America, all of this should be in common. And remember, this is an interesting distinction. There's a difference between public property and the commons. The commons is something that, without law, belongs to everybody. Even the people of the United States, in the form of their government, does not own this land. It's not like public land, like Yellowstone National Park. No, it's not. It means that you would take this whole park and all the public lands where these pigs are drilling right now, and where Obama is giving them all they want by playing golf with them and having fun. These people would not have access to that to that land, because it would belong to everybody. And everybody would certainly not, that is you, me, and everybody else, there's no way we would allow them to use that land. We would take their stuff away. We would kick them out. They are destroying that land. So there's a difference between public land and the commons. The commons are, should be, almost everything. And that includes a lot of stuff that goes on in the internet. All these attacks by private companies on software and hardware and broadband and everything, which they're constantly trying to do, the internet has to stay our commons because free speech has been commodified now. There's an old newspaper saying that says there is freedom of speech to anyone who owns one, to anyone who owns a press. Oh, I'm sorry. There is freedom of the press to anyone who owns one. You own a printing press, you have freedom of speech. You don't own it, you don't. And they're trying to privatize the First Amendment. They're trying to privatize our space. That's why the Occupy movement was violating their basic laws. Public space, space that should belong to everyone, parks and everything else, that should be ours, all of ours, they privatize, they commodify, and they send their cops in, their Dobermans, to kick people out and beat people up, to throw them off common space, right? And common space is where people should have the right to collect, to exercise free speech. They have taken all the broadband. They've taken the airwaves. They will take our heads and our knees and our feet and our mouths, necks, and our hearts if we let them. They'll privatize your nose. This is the way the world is going. Anyhow, the wealth of the commons, a world beyond market and state. We need to think about how to change things without all this government and without all these laws. No more. They don't help us.